Oh, Brad, what have you done now?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Brad Gilmore Show on demand. Another great episode for you. Welcome back to the show. It's been an interesting couple weeks for me here at the Brad Gilmore Show and doing a lot of things in my career. We have a great episode for you today, though. Today, I have the one and only Joe Toplin. Joe Toplin is the author of comedy writing for late night TV. How to write monologue jokes, desk pieces, sketches, parodies, audience pieces, remotes, and other short-form comedy. A textbook for a guy like me who has grown up loving Johnny Carson and The Tonight Show and David Letterman and Jay Leno, Conan O'Brien, so on and so forth. Awesome read for me. Joe and I talked a couple weeks ago, maybe about a month ago, and we talk about his career in writing. He wrote for David Letterman, wrote for Jay Leno, and a multitude of other things, so we got to talk about it all. He even wrote for Chevy Chase in the short-lived Chevy Chase late-night television show. So we're going to talk about all of that today on the podcast with Joe Toplin. But one thing I really want to talk about here at the top of the show is I've got to make a little plug. I don't make a lot of plugs often anymore, but I got to make a plug. August the 3rd, 2017. We're going to have a monumentous occasion in my life, at least for me. On that day, at 7 o'clock, Houston, Texas time, that's Central Standard Time, I will be attending a red carpet premiere for the romantic comedy Live, Love, Laugh, directed by DJ Young Sam. And I'm excited for this because this is my big screen debut. Yes, I shot this movie a couple years ago, and it's finally coming out. I had a small role, but an impactful one. You can see me in the trailer. I play a guy named Donnie Williams, agent to the stars, and I'm trying to sign a new client, kind of like Ari Gold. And I got to kind of tap into that a little bit. I had a lot of fun with the project. And actually, after seeing the scene kind of cut together and seeing the trailer, I gotta say the acting bug has started a little bit, brother. It started a little bit. But I just want to plug that. If y'all are in the Houston area, you want to go to bdboent.com. That's bdboent.com. This is taking place in River Oaks, baby. The big River O. 2009 West Gray Street here in Houston, Texas. Like I said, go to that website, bdboent.com. You can get your tickets there. As well as if you look at my Instagram or Twitter page, I'm sure I've tweeted a link out about it already. So enjoy. If you want to come out, check it out. We'll take some pictures. We'll have some laughs. And we'll see how much of an idiot I look on a massive big screen. Also, going down August the 12th, Booker T's World Gym Arena in Texas City, Texas. It's the Summer of Champions 4, the biggest event in reality of wrestling history. We're going to have the Boogeyman is going to be a special guest, and just announced Ruthless Ryan Davidson and a partner of his choosing is going to go against Stevie Ray, yes, of Harlem Heat, and Abel Andrew Jackson, as well as Aiden Cristiano defends his Reality of Wrestling Championship against the two-time champ Gino, and the special guest referee is the Booker Man, Booker T himself. So all that going down on August the 12th, go to realitywrestling.com for information there. Okay, now that I've got that out of the way, let's go into my interview with Joe Toplin. We talk about late night television. We talk about Stephen Colbert's dominance of Jimmy Fallon as of late with the political climate as it is. He seems to be thriving. We also talk about when Conan left The Tonight Show and the craziness that ensued and much, much more. So y'all check it out. My interview with the one and the only, the author of an amazing book called Comedy Writing for Late Night TV. Here he is, Joe Toplin. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Brad Gilmore here. A very, very, very special guest on the phone with me right now. He is he was on the writing staff for Late Night with David Letterman, co-head writer of The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, and then the head writer of The Late Show with David Letterman, of course, or the Late Show with David Letterman, of course, and written for several other projects on television, nominated for over a dozen Emmy nominations. Really amazing career. I'm pleased to have Joe Toplin on the phone with me right now. Joe, how are you?
I'm great, Brad. Hey, thanks for that generous introduction.
Hey, no problem at all. I mean, your career speaks for itself. I'm holding your book in my hands right now, Comedy Writing for Late Night Television, How to Write Monologue Jokes, Desk Pieces, Sketches, Parodies, Audience Pieces, Remotes, and Other Short-Form Comedy. Really, if anyone out there is a late-night junkie like I am, I found this book on Amazon, and I sped through it in probably about two weeks to really kind of absorb everything. And then I started following you on Twitter, and I was like, man, here's the thing. As a university student, you spend a lot of money on textbooks, right? And you spend a lot of money on textbooks you never plan on ever using again after that semester's over. This is the ultimate textbook for me. This is one of the coolest things I've ever read. I mean, I'm not just saying it because you're on the phone. This is one of the coolest books I've ever read, and I'm so happy I was able to find it on Amazon.com. So, Joe, how are you today?
Thank you. I'm great. Thanks for saying those nice things about the book.
Oh man, the book is awesome. Can I start with the book here? How long did that take you to put together? Because it's very detailed. It's very detailed. How long did that take you to get?
I did not want to leave anything out. I didn't want to publish it and then think to myself, "Oh, I wish I had talked about remotes or I left this out." I just wanted to get it all down. It actually took a bunch of years, and the reason a bunch of years to write it, because what it was kind of an expanded and more in-depth version of a class that I taught for years at the People's Improv Theater in New York. I was working on Monk, and I have a friend who was also working on Monk who knows the founder of the PIT, the People's Improv Theater, and the founder's Ali Farinakian, and so my friend said, "Well, why don't you talk to Ali? He's looking for people to teach at the PIT." And I said, "Well, sure, I'd be interested in teaching something." And so I came up with this idea to teach a class in how to write comedy for late night TV, and that means I had to figure out how to teach how to write comedy for late night TV, and so I put together a course outline that covered everything that's in the book now: monologue, joke writing, and desk pieces, and sketches, and parodies, and audience pieces. And so I taught the class for a few years. So that was kind of the basis of the book. That was the outline of the book. I figured out how to teach how to write a joke and all the other stuff. And then eventually I had some time and I said, well, there seems to be a demand for what's in the class, and not everybody can get to Manhattan to take the class, and I don't teach it more than a few times a year. So why don't I just turn this into a book? So it was the years of working out the material at the PIT, followed by at least a year or two of really going into detail as far as collecting the examples. Whenever I teach how to write a certain kind of monologue joke, I'd hunt online for examples from the late night shows, from actual late night monologues that demonstrate the principles. And so the actual writing was at least a year, possibly two.
It definitely shows. Like I said, I mean, it's so detailed, and it's, you know, for anyone who's like a long time late night fan, or even a short term late night fan, it's just so cool to kind of get inside the writer's head, and in someone who's there on a daily basis, just to grind out five shows a week and have every show be funny and try to top the next one takes a lot of effort, takes a lot of talent. So this is my favorite textbook I've ever purchased, and
it makes sense.
It makes sense. You taught a class about it beforehand. It kind of reads like an instruction manual. You have a really interesting career. You started off your comedy writing for late night with David Letterman, who, you know, just retired here not too long ago, one of the greatest to ever do it. But you started over actually as a student at Harvard. You have an MBA from Harvard. interestingly enough, it seems like some of the real funny guys come from Harvard. Were you a member of the Lampoon at all, or no?
I was on the Lampoon, and that was my first kind of immersion in the world of comedy. One of the pieces of advice I give in my book is that if you're interested in pursuing comedy professionally or in any depth, it's a really good idea to get involved in the comedy community, because that's where you you learn techniques and you trade tips. And if you have a writing sample, you can bounce it off somebody else in the comedy community and they'll give you notes on it, and you can give your notes on their material. So the Lampoon was really my first entry into the comedy community. And I just had I had a great time there. I was also an engineering major, so I had these two sides of these two avocations, the engineering and eventually business. But also I stayed interested in comedy. And at one point I got an opportunity to submit to Late Night with David Letterman when the show was still fairly young. And how I got to do that was one of the head writers for Late Night was a friend of mine who I knew from the Lampoon. So being part of the comedy community did pay off, because I maintained that contact, and Jim Downey was generous enough to give me a call when he knew that Late Night was going to be needing writers. And I wrote a writing sample, and Dave liked it, and that was the start of my professional comedy career.
So first day working at the Late Night with David Letterman, of course, the show that he started on over on NBC for, I think it was like, 13 or 14 years he hosted that show. On your first day in, did you ever hear the rumors about David Letterman before? I know that you said it was early in his tenure, but, you know, I always heard the rumors of Dave was very interesting guy to work with. Did you have any of those? Did you know any of those rumors going into it? And how was your first day at the show?
In the early days, Dave was a lot more accessible to the writing staff than he was later on, and especially during the CBS years. My first day was there were four or five writers on the staff who were leaving. And they were the ones who created the openings for me and a few other writers to join the staff. And so the first day was hi, we're the old writers and we're leaving and good luck. There was also there was a feeling of, oh, how do we new writers not mess this up? Then the next thing was, how do we put comedy on the show? Because these guys heading out the door are not really concerned about getting comedy pieces up. But actually, there were a couple of comedy pieces in the pipeline that got us through the first couple of days. There was a new gift items piece. I remember that George Meyer was assembling, and he needed jokes for it. This is a prop piece where Dave says, "Oh, here are some new items you can buy in the store." And they're all funny props that have actually been made by the prop department based on the writer's crazy ideas. So George Meyer was putting this piece together, and bless him, he looked at some of the I had happened to have written some wacky prop piece ideas for my writing submission, which I had just used to get a job. And George read them. And he said, "Oh, these are good." And so some of them went immediately into the wacky prop piece. And were produced and made by the prop department and used on the show in the next couple of days. We did takes a couple of days to make the actual props. So my first day there was what are we all going to do? How do we keep this going? How do we top what comedy's already been on the show? Because George Meyer and Meryl Marco and Jim Downey and all of the original writers, Max Prost and Tom Gamble, were really good at creating pieces for the show that we could then just keep doing, and also setting a tone with Dave for what the comedy should be and what the show should be like. So our job was basically to keep doing that and hopefully do it in a fresh way, to come up with new pieces like the ones they've been doing. But they really kind of set the template that made it a little easier for us to kind of keep the show going during that, after that change of staff.
And so for Late Night, what was your tenure? How long were you there at Late Night with David Letterman?
Late Night with David Letterman, 83 to 90.
83 to 90. And the whole time, you know, obviously your lead-in was still Johnny Carson, with the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. How was it to follow? Because, you know, everyone loved Johnny. I mean, everyone of all ages loved Johnny Carson. He was the guy. And, you know, he would come in with the monologue that everyone would tune in for. That's why you wanted to watch Johnny. Your comedy on Late Night with David Letterman was to a different audience, wouldn't you say? A more younger, maybe a bit hipper of an audience, not so much the catch-all everyman style of Johnny Carson. Was there a plan in the writing room? Did y'all have a certain vision for Late Night with David Letterman to make it specifically different than The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson? Obviously, it's going to be different because of the hosts. But was the writing, was it skewed to be purposefully different?
We all admire Johnny Carson and his show, but we never really use that as a kind of a benchmark to compare ourselves to. We didn't explicitly say, oh, Johnny does this sort of piece. You know, we're going to do something else that's not that. It was, if there was any talk about that, that would have taken place before I arrived at Late Night, between Meryl Marco and Dave. And I think that the sort of comedy that we did on Late Night was more just a reflection of what Dave and Meryl wanted to do and what the rest of the writers convinced Dave to do than it was like a conscious reaction against Johnny in particular. I think it was more a general kind of making fun of and playing with the TV shows in general, the theme shows and the action shows and sitcoms. We'd do our own funny versions of that, and it was kind of nice that Johnny wasn't doing that sort of comedy. He didn't do sketches. He didn't do. I don't think he did prop pieces. I don't think he did art card pieces. There are a lot of pieces that we did because we wanted to do them and Dave wanted to do them that Johnny just wasn't doing. But we did them because we wanted to do them, not because Johnny wasn't doing them.
So it was more just y'all were doing your own thing, not really trying too hard to be the counter-programming to a Johnny Carson or to follow in his footsteps. It was more free-form, do your own thing.
That's it, yeah. I've heard that there were a couple of areas where the Late Night producers and Dave were told, don't do this because Johnny does that. Mm-hmm. For example, I've heard that we always called Dave's opening half dozen or so jokes his opening remarks. We couldn't call it a monologue. And I heard that was because somebody in Johnny's camp said, no, Johnny does the monologue. You don't do the monologue. You do something else. And so we said, all right, it's opening remarks. And also, I'm sure there was a little bit of competition on the guest in the talent department, who gets what guest. But
obviously, the better guests go to Johnny, right?
The better guests go to Johnny, and then we get the not necessarily the B level guests, but we get the brother Theodores and the Harvey P cars.
and
it was because, well, you know. Clint Eastwood isn't going to appear on our show.
Yeah.
He's going to go on Johnny's show.
Yeah, Sylvester Stallone's going to do The Tonight Show. So during your time there, you know, toward 90, Johnny Carson announced, I believe, his retirement from The Tonight Show in 91. But there's that interesting movie. I'm sure you've read the books. I mean, I know I've read them backwards and forwards a million times. The Bill Carter books. And,
great books.
Fantastic. Bill Carter, I mean, really goes in depth, detailed like you were in your book as well. And the Late Shift, the first book that he wrote about the transition from Letterman, from Carson to Letterman and Leno, trying to see who's going to get the Tonight Show. You were working around these guys, and you were working obviously in comedy writing. What do you remember about that time where the transition from Johnny to Leno and all the craziness that ensued? What do you remember? Do you recall like Leno and Letterman and all the animosity? Were you there in some of these meetings? Were you hearing rumors? Like, what was going on at that time?
You know, I was out of Late Night at that time. If that was 91, I would have been working on In Living Color, writing sketches, and then I worked on my first sitcom, Doctor Doctor. So I wasn't really in touch with anybody inside of either of those camps. I was kind of getting my information secondhand. But I think when we were on Late Night, and when I left Late Night, a few other writers did at the same time, and we all kind of moved out to Los Angeles to try our luck out there. But there was a feeling of Dave's going to get the Tonight Show, and I wonder when. You know, I hope it's soon. And then we left, and then I guess the feeling was, well, okay, now Dave gets to get the Tonight Show. And then it wasn't until I read Bill Carter's book that I realized, oh my gosh, the political maneuvering and the fist fights and the subterfuges
and the closet hiding.
The closet hiding, yeah, the eavesdropping the phone on the phone calls,
yeah.
So it was really a fascinating story, and knowing both Jay and Dave, a lot of the book rang true. I can see both sides. I can see why Dave was the heir apparent, and he's earned the position. He's earned the Tonight Show, but at the same time, Jay's really funny and he's really good, and he did a great job guest hosting on the Tonight Show, and I could see where his personality and his willingness to work with the affiliates and all the stuff that all the responsibilities that a host of one of these shows has, in addition to just doing the comedy and being on camera, I can see where NBC valued that too. So it was fascinating how it played out.
Oh, I mean, yeah, it's one of the most interesting stories of all time. And then there's also the HBO movie of the same name, where it's all acted out by a myriad of actors. Now, so you were in L.A. writing, you said, your sitcom, Dr. Doctor. You were working on In Living Color in 1990, 1991. When did you go back into Late Night and start working again with Jay Leno? Because I know you went and started working on The Tonight Show after Late Night. So what made you go back to Late Night television?
You know, what drew me back to Late Night television was The Chevy Chase Show.
Oh, yeah, which, the classic.
Yeah, that was, we all thought this was going to be great. Everybody loves Chevy. It would be my chance to kind of be in at the ground floor, on the ground floor of a new show, which I hadn't done. I certainly didn't have any kind of leadership role on any other startup show, and this would be my chance to kind of, you know, hire a staff and give input on the direction of the show and the tone. So I was co-head writer on the Chevy Chase Show, and it didn't last long at all. But was it fun?
Was it nine episodes? I think that it went, or something like that.
It was 5 weeks, and I think it was 23 episodes.
5 weeks, okay, 5 weeks. Okay.
5 weeks, 23 episodes. We did. I'm still proud of most of the comedy that we did. One of the things that we did was my first hidden camera prank, which was where Chevy pretends that he has this second job, which is acting as a wax mannequin of himself in the Hollywood Wax Museum. So it's this remote tape where Chevy kind of clocks in at the Hollywood Wax Museum, goes upstairs, puts on this heavy makeup, and sits down in a tableau of waxen late night talk show hosts, Arsenio Hall and people like that. And then he startles tourists coming through the gallery of late night hosts. And it worked really great. It killed. So that was one of the comedy pieces that we did.
I don't mean to cut you off, but why did the Chevy Chase Show not work? Was it because of the network? I mean, was it because of the competition?
I think Chevy didn't enjoy the talking to guests part of it, which I think he would have been happier doing a show that was closer to Saturday Night Live. A lot of produced comedy, a lot of scripted stuff, and he could play characters, which he always has been great at, but you just can't do that 5 nights a week. It's just there's not enough money to hire the staff to write all that stuff, and there's not enough time to rehearse it and produce it. So you're stuck inevitably, as you are, doing a show like this, with a lot of the show is sitting down and talking to people, and I I don't think he was very interested in doing that part of it.
Oh, man. You know, because one of the greatest comedic minds. So then from the Chevy Chase show, you went to The Tonight Show.
Yes, I went pretty much directly to The Tonight Show. It was, in fact, I was cleaning out my desk at the Chevy Chase show, and I get a call, and it's The Tonight Show, and they ask if I'd like to come in and talk to Jay. And I said, yeah, because I was a huge fan of Jay. He was a great guest on Late Night with David Letterman, and whenever he was on the show, sometimes he'd stop up to the writer's offices and poke his head in the room and make a joke, and always admired him. And so the chance to be working back in Late Night on a show that was had every indication that it was going to last longer than the Chevy Chase show. Sounded like a great experience, and it was.
You know, in the comedy community, Jay Leno was kind of regarded, especially in the late 80s, mid-late 80s and early 90s, he was regarded as one of the greatest stand-ups of all time. I've even heard David Letterman say he's the greatest stand-up he's ever seen. Yep. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yes. Yes, I would.
And why? What makes Jay so good? Because when you think of the comedy greats, you think of Seinfeld, you think of Pryor, you think of Chris Rock. What was it about Jay Leno's stand-up?
Well, he's been doing it, and I don't mean to belittle Jerry Seinfeld, Richard Pryor, and there are a lot of great comics, stand-up comics. But Jay has to be at or near the top. And I think a big part of it is, in addition to just his skill at writing jokes and delivering the jokes, is he's such a hard worker. He would just as I understand him growing up and getting into the business, he would do anything to just perform and work on his material and get better. So I think that was a big part of it, is he really worked hard to get really good at what he does. And I think the second part is he's very easy to work with. He's people like him. He's you want to kind of hang out with him. He's the kind of guy you'd want to be a buddy with. And I think that comes through also when he's doing a stand up, and certainly when he was hosting The Tonight Show. He's just got that likability quotient that makes you want to tune in every night and see what he has to say about what's going on the news.
Now, you were at The Tonight Show from what years?
Let's see. 94 and 95.
94 and 95. 94 and 95. So, I mean, this was right around where Jay was, for a while, was having a rough time in The Tonight Show. You know, he got a lot of criticism for not thinking Johnny on his first night, and then he was really having a hard time beating Dave. I mean, it was losing to Late Night with Dave in the ratings. I mean, every night. What was it that for Jay, and how did Jay get the finally start beating Dave and become number one?
Well, when I got that call, I was on the Chevy Chase show, and Chevy Chase show had just been canceled. That was during the period when The Tonight Show was kind of having a hard time against Dave. I think Dave Letterman had just gone on the air at CBS opposite The Tonight Show for the first time, maybe less than a year before that. And Jay was getting hammered by the critics and the ratings. Dave was beating him in the ratings. And so it was kind of a tough time, and I think that's one of the reasons why the Tonight Show, I don't know whether it was network executives or Jay or producers, decided, well, let's try and beef up the comedy a little bit. Let's bring in another comedy guy, which turned out to be me. So I get over to the Tonight Show, and Jay was great. The staff was great. The monologue writers, especially, were really great. They knew what they were doing, and so there was a lot of good stuff at the Tonight Show. There just kind of had to be a little bit of adjustment, and so that's kind of what I did, was I just started throwing in suggestions. Let's try this. Let's try this. Ooh, that worked. Let's do more of that. Just all the old tricks that I learned working for Dave. if a comedy piece is working, do it again, do it again, do it again until people get sick of it, and then do something like that, and then do that again and again. Because there's a lot of comedy slots you have to fill up on every show, so ideas are very important. So that was one thing that I think started to help the Tonight Show regain its footing and close the ratings gap with Dave was we started doing comedy pieces that I knew that Jay would be great at, but at the same time that Dave would never do. Anything that involved Jay wearing a costume, he would do, but Dave would never put on a costume. He'd never wear like a funny hat or anything for comedy. So that was the kind of piece that we would have Jay doing. Dave had stopped at that point going out onto the street to do what we call remote pieces. He used to be great at those. He used to do them all the time. And they were just really solid comedy pieces on a show. And Dave stopped doing them, and Jay was happy to do them. So he said, all right, let's keep doing these remote pieces. And every Wednesday, Jay would go out, no matter what was going on. The show would end, and it would be, okay, let's go out and do a remote piece. And one of the pieces that we did that was very successful that the show had already been doing when I arrived, but it was one of the pieces where I said, wow, that's great, let's do that again, was a jaywalking piece. The jaywalking pieces where Jay goes out and asks people on the street, just average people, questions that they really should know the answer to. And they inevitably did not know the answer. And that would be funny. And you edit them together and you have a funny comedy piece. So that's an example of a piece that Jay could do and was great at and was really good that Dave wasn't doing at that point. And then there was the O.J. Simpson murder case. The O.J. Simpson murder trial was a huge story that arose when I was there. And the staff and Jay just kind of figured out a way to extract comedy from that horrible double murder, and it was a tricky challenge. Like, how do you make jokes about something that is so horrible when you think about the details, but at the same time, people want to hear you address it in your comedy, because the whole country was talking about OJ and what happened and Judge Ito and the where's the real killer. And so that was another example of something that we did on the Tonight Show that Dave was not doing, which is we did a lot of comedy about the OJ Simpson trial. And so that, I think, helped kind of the ratings increased a little bit more, maybe. We got a new studio for Jay. He used to be in the old Johnny Carson studio, and then we did a week of shows in New York where he was closer to the audience, and he came back to Los Angeles and he said, you know, what do you think about a new studio where I'm closer to the audience? Because that really felt, it felt like more me being a stand-up, which is what I like to do. So NBC moved across the hall, built him a new studio, and that gave the show a whole new look that was not like Johnny's Tonight Show. It was Jay's Tonight Show. So a bunch of factors that eventually started to close the rating gap. And then we had the fortuitous appearance of Hugh Grant. Actor Hugh Grant had just gotten arrested with a prostitute and on Hollywood Boulevard, something like that. It was like a huge pop culture show business story. And to his credit, Hugh Grant was booked on The Tonight Show and did not cancel. He agreed to come on the show as planned. And so we knew that a lot of people were going to tune into that particular episode. And we were, at that point, we were winning a couple nights a week in the ratings because of ER. ER was a great lead in. So that was another thing that happened was NBC started to put on great primetime shows. And so we were winning a couple nights, and the Hugh Grant appearance kind of put us over the top for the week. That was the first week that the Tonight Show actually beat Dave in the ratings for, I think, since Dave came on the air at CBS. So after that, it was kind of no looking back for the Tonight Show. They held on to a lot of people who maybe hadn't seen the Tonight Show in a while, tuned in for the Hugh Grant episode, saw that we did solid comedy, and then we did solid comedy the next night. And we managed to hold on to a lot of those viewers who were new to The Tonight Show or who came back after having tuned out a while ago. And then Jay just, he stayed on top for pretty much every week for the next 17 or 18 years.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you always hear, you know, about the Hugh Grant moment, and that was really the kickoff. But it's really interesting to hear all the little things that led up to it, including the O.J. Simpson trial. You know, you always hear about Jay Leno and the fact that the man loves to work. He does not like sitting around and staring at the wall. Like, he waits to go to work. He's excited to get to work. And I'm sure as a comedy writer, to have the star of the show just be wanting to work all the time and reading through monologue joke after monologue joke and looking at this and this and that, I would think that it helps breed, you know, creativity. It helps spark ideas when you have someone who's so invested in what's going into the show.
And also, so there was a lot of opportunity for comedy, and there was a lot of opportunity for new ideas too. Jay was willing to try stuff, which if you're a writing staff trying to figure out how to improve the comedy, it's good to have a host who will try stuff and not resist fresh ideas, because then if it works, then you have a whole new area of comedy that you can keep writing and putting on the show. For example, the costumed characters that we came up with, Mr. Brain, which was a comedy piece where Jay, through an optical effect, he looks like he has an electronic visual effect. He looks like he has a huge head, like he's some super genius from outer space. He's really obnoxious, and he answers questions in a very obnoxious, funny way, like a superior know-it-all. And that opened up a whole new area of comedy, is making Jay one of these joke delivery characters, which I have to say was a case. We were talking about Johnny Carson. It was a case where something that Carson did influenced something that we did on another show, which is Johnny's Karnak the Magnificent, where he puts on the huge floppy turban. Yeah. And then he does jokes in the character of this Swami. So he said, I said, well, I wonder if we could do a character like that. Let's come up with a character for Jay. And then we had the idea for Mr. Brain.
You know, the thing, though, about Karnak that was so great and which made it work for me was he had the perfect – Johnny had the perfect man – setting up the jokes for him in Ed McMahon. And yeah. You talk about, and I'm so fascinated by Ed McMahon, but people don't realize, when you think of, you know, late night shows, you think of the guy, you think of Carson, Letterman, Leno, Conan, Jimmy, any of the Jimmys on TV right now, Colbert, you think of the star of the show. The sidekick to me is such an important role, and it's really overlooked a lot. I mean, Ed McMahon, obviously, probably the greatest of all time, but what do you think about the sidekick and the role the sidekick plays in a late night talk show?
I agree the sidekick is very important. The sidekick does a few things. The sidekick can be someone who helps out in the comedy, like on Karnak, the sidekick feeds lines to Johnny, and Johnny does the joke, and Jay had sidekicks doing that too. They usually it was Branford Marsalis, and could have been the announcer Ed Hall did it for a while. So it's good to have someone who you can include in the comedy when you need somebody to do the setups, for example. And also the sidekick can add a kind of an outsider's perspective. Like if the host says something and the sidekick thinks, oh, I wonder if that was clear for the audience, the sidekick can be the one to say, oh, you mean this? And then the host has the chance to clarify. And the sidekick can be a sounding board during the show. If something odd is happening, if an interview is going sideways, the sidekick can kind of be a give feedback to the host and allow the host to kind of make an adjustment about what to do about this interview. So the sidekick is like your best buddy, the host's best buddy, your best friend on the show, and has your back and helps where needed to help make the host look good.
Do you think Ed McMahon was the best?
He was certainly great. There have been so many sidekicks. I think Paul Schaefer,
another great one,
has been just world class. especially in the area of participating in the comedy. I did plenty of comedy pieces where Paul was acting. I was acting with Paul, and he always nailed the comedy. He always did everything we wanted and more, as everything the writers did and wanted him to do and more. And a very, very great guy, and also great during the show. Really did all those things that I was talking about sidekicks doing. He did that for Dave. Paul was terrific.
Paul was a great, you know, sometimes you forget about Paul Schaefer. He was fantastic. You were at the Tonight Show for those two years, 94, 95. And then after that, you went back to David Letterman, right? And you went to work for The Late Show.
That's right. Back to The Late Show, back to the East Coast. I just decided I had a family, and I just wanted them to move back east. I wanted my kids to have an East Coast upbringing, and so I worked for Dave for another 6 years at CBS at 11:30.
So that was from, 95 to, early 2000s, or 2001, 2002?
Yeah.
And that was really, I think, when David Letterman, went from late-night talk show host to kind of cultural icon, pop cultural icon. In those years, I mean, obviously he was there in the 80s and the 90s, early 90s, but I think that he really reached, he reached almost that Carson level, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
To where it's like he was so important to television and especially, and if you were there in 2001, I mean, David Letterman was kind of the guy that everyone looked to in late night after 9/11, and he was the leader. He was the leader of the late night pack. As much as Jay Leno was number one in the Tonight Show, Dave was really the leader.
Yeah, he was, especially being in New York for the tragedy of 2001, 9/11. He was the person everybody turned to kind of help us define how to process this and how do we go on and what's happening with the world. I remember I was in the office. We were working that day, and I watched at least one of the towers fall, and it was just people were just stunned. And I don't think we were doing a show that night, so we just kind of all went home. And boy, I don't know what I would have done if I had to be the one to come back on the television and kind of do a show and it kind of summarize what we were all feeling and give voice to the incredible tragedy and our feelings. But Dave did it. And, he was just, he was the spokesman for, I think, what we were all feeling. So amazing job.
I mean, incredible job. So you're working for David Letterman for a long time. How was he different, from the late night years, compared to the CBS Late Show years?
Well, at that point, by the time we get to CBS, there was a time early in his tenure at CBS when he was still doing the remote pieces, a lot of them that he used to do on late night. He was still doing some prop comedy. But at that point, I was on The Tonight Show. But when I came back to work at CBS, I was kind of a little surprised that he wasn't as willing to do the comedy that he used to do on late night, because that's what I remember most fondly about late night was just Dave would be pretty much willing to try anything, any sort of comedy piece that you could come up with. He'd say, all right, sure. I'll ride through a car wash in a convertible with the top down. Why not? and he would do it. So I came back to CBS and I hadn't realized at first that he was really leaning away from a lot of that comedy that he used to do. And he was transitioning more toward what you were talking about, more of someone who, like a broadcaster, someone who kind of spoke to the audience and was less concerned with doing these produced comedy pieces. So I think that was the big difference, was at that point, The Tonight Show was beating The Late Show in the ratings, and I thought, well, maybe Dave is going to be trying to do innovative comedy again and try to get back to to doing what he was doing on late night, but he really wasn't. He had a different vision for the show at that point than I thought he would.
You know, so you work for David Letterman on two different occasions, two separate points in his career. Jay Leno, of course, in the time to where he was, you know, being beaten by Dave and then overcoming Dave. For you, working with both men, who was more fun to work with?
I think the true answer, and it's going to sound like I'm just kind of splitting differences, they were both fun to work with. I would say certainly Dave in the late night years was just great. He'd write something and he'd say, sure, I'll ride on a flatbed truck on my desk at 60 miles an hour, do a comedy piece. So they were just, I had a lot of adventures with Dave. But at the same time, when I got to the Tonight Show, I had the same adventures with Jay. Jay and I would be at a drag strip or up at the Hollywood sign, throwing stuff through the D in the Hollywood sign. And so I got to relive my late night adventures with Dave with Jay. So I don't think I can decide.
It is rough. It is rough. But I know you did spend a lot of time with David Letterman, and I'm sure you have a little bit of a little bit. You might have a proclivity for Dave, but it's I understand they're both awesome to work with. I can't imagine getting to work with either one of them. Let me ask you this. In 2004, and I just want to get, obviously you weren't there for this, but I do want to get your analysis of it, since you were a fan of the Bill Carter books like I. In 2004, NBC came to Jay and said, in 5 years, we're going to put Conan in your place. And then they moved Jay to the prime time slot, and we all know what happened after that. They wanted to move Jay back to 11:35. Conan didn't want to go to midnight. That whole time.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting time period. The subject of Bill Carter's second book. If you, and I know you're a comedy writer and you're a talent, so it's hard to look at it from the other side, but if you were NBC and you were trying to make, a decision on what to do, do you think, because I think of it all the time, and really when you look back at it, they made a decision that made sense for them and made sense. They got to keep both of their stars and everyone's happy. When you think of that time, would you have done anything differently? And what did you think of the way that whole situation played out?
It played out very awkwardly, and I think it really made NBC look bad. I think they. It's so hard to second guess. I think they were probably. You look at the situation, and Jay was number one in late night. And yeah, I guess NBC was looking at it and they were saying, well, is Jay always going to be number one? And they said, well, we have to plan ahead. We have to start the succession. I think that might've been a little premature. I think, I think if you've got the host of the number one show in late night, you'll let him keep doing what he's doing. And I realized that Conan was champing at the bit and wanted more than 12:30. But I'm also a huge fan of Conan, and I've worked on that 12:30 show, and I know how much fun that can be. So I suppose a possible solution would have been just push everything back, just say, Conan, can't you hear? Here's another dump truck full of money.
Just go back a half hour.
Do the great show that you're. Well, I was going to say stay at
12:30. Okay,
stay at 12:30 for a while longer, and we'll pay you a lot more money because he does a great show, but he still does a great show on TBS, and so then if they could have maintained the status quo a little bit longer, I think that might have been a better solution. Just express their appreciation for Conan in a different way.
I just think, though, that Conan, I love Conan at 12:30, And, you know, you can make the argument maybe he didn't play well at 11:35. I remember watching those first Tonight shows in for Conan, and I actually thought they were really good. I enjoyed Conan as the host of the Tonight Show. But I think, though, he should have just moved back a half hour. I know that he had that whole thing about, you know, it's the franchise of the Tonight Show, I don't want to destroy it. But I really think moving back a half hour, you're still the host. Jay's only going to do it for 3-4 more years. Hold out until he's done doing his half-hour show. And there you are. I really think that would have been the best thing for him.
Yeah, maybe so. It's
because as much as I love Conan, now he's in TBS, and I hate to say it, as much as I love him, he's kind of just floating in no man's land. Like, he's really not – he's not talked about as much anymore now that he's on TBS.
Yeah. Well, who knew how this was all going to play out?
Yeah.
And I think TBS is a – I think he just signed a new contract at TBS.
Yeah,
so he gets to – I mean, it's all about – under the circumstances, if it were me, I would be thinking, I still get to do what I love doing. And, you know, I still get to have my own show and do smart comedy and be funny. And I really do think he has some of the funniest, best written comedy in late night.
Yeah, Conan's sharp. Conan's real sharp. I love the stuff that he does on his show.
He really makes an effort to come up with fresh ideas. I think they're a higher priority for him than they are for some of the other late night shows.
Yeah, his remote pieces are really good.
Yes, and he still does the remotes. Who else is doing remotes?
Mm-hmm.
James Corden does remotes, I guess. Jimmy Fallon doesn't do remotes.
No.
I don't think Seth Meyers does remotes. I think Jimmy Kimmel, when he does have remotes, I don't think it's Jimmy on location. I think it's somebody else. So yeah, Conan's doing that too, which nobody else really does in late night.
Let me ask you this. A couple more things before we get you out of here. I mean, this has been an awesome conversation. I could talk to you all day. There's a lot being made. You know, I follow you on Twitter, and what I love is you put out kind of like monologue style jokes on your timeline at Joe Toplin on Twitter. And what I've noticed,
thanks for the plug.
No problem. What I've noticed though is that you definitely play both sides of the political spectrum. You had a joke just yesterday about Hillary Clinton and her election loss. I mean, you've definitely had jokes about Donald Trump and you play both sides of it, which I think is what Jay always did, is what Johnny always did, and it's what Jimmy Fallon is doing. And he's been the subject of a recent New York Times piece. I saw an article on TheRinger.com about how it's you can no longer be apolitical under Donald Trump as a late night host. And you know what? There's some merit to the argument because he's slipping in the ratings. Stephen Colbert, who had a really, really rough start as the host of The Late Show, taking over for Dave, is now creeping up. He might win the television season, which would be the historic for that franchise. Do you think, though, a late night show host has to be politically slanted in order to be successful right now?
I think it depends on what you mean by politically slanted. Yeah, when I write my little Twitter jokes, I do aim for the same target that Jay aimed for, and that's everybody. If you're the host of The Tonight Show or the host of The Late Show, I think your job is to be number one at 11:30, and that means attracting as many viewers as possible, and that means not alienating half your potential audience by delivering a joke that is so slanted that half the audience is going to say, well, I don't like you, I'm not going to watch you anymore. So I think it's definitely possible to do political comedy. In fact, I think it's essential to do political comedy. But I think I've read a couple of these articles you're talking about, and I think you can make a joke about Donald Trump or a joke about Hillary Clinton that pretty much everybody will laugh at, or at least be willing to laugh at. So that way you're making a political joke, but you're not alienating half your potential audience and causing your ratings to take a nosedive. So I think it all depends on fine-tuning your writing. It's what can you say about Donald Trump that even fans of Donald Trump will agree that's true about Donald Trump, And it's maybe doesn't make them look great, but it's true and it's funny, and I'm willing to laugh at that. I think it's when the punchlines to your jokes are, oh, Hillary Clinton is Hitler and Donald Trump is Hitler, that people say, well, wait a second.
Yeah,
I don't agree with that.
I'm
not
going to
watch you.
The way I said it is I think that a late night host has to comment on current events, and you have to talk about what's going on in the news. I mean, that's why people tune into the monologue. But
absolutely.
The way I say it is, though, to be politically apolitical, meaning make the jokes like you're saying about everybody. Kind of be even keeled and even make the jokes that, you know, like you said, Trump supporters would laugh at themselves, and not alienate the audience. And to me, I mean, politics aside, I just think that Stephen Colbert's strategy is a short term. You know, I always think that if Hillary won, where would he be now? You know?
Yeah, it's I think the key is not to be, as I was saying, not to be so clearly kind of one-sided. And what was it? In fact, Colbert got in trouble for a joke that he told a week or so ago, but something about Vladimir Putin, something holster. And,
yes, yes, of course, yes.
And that's the sort of joke I say, all right. Did you have to be that graphic? Did you have to be that kind of in your face so that someone who did happen to think, well, maybe that's a little unfair for Donald Trump to say that about Donald Trump, so that person kind of still stays in your camp? I mean, that's you want to do it. I think that probably I may agree with the joke. I may not agree with the joke. But the point is, if you're the late show and you're trying to attract viewers, you need 4 million viewers a night.
Yeah.
You know, if you're Samantha Bee on cable, a million viewers is fine. You can take sides, and a million people on that side will watch your show, and that will pay the bills. If you're hosting a big-time network talk show, a million viewers is not going to be enough. You need 4 or 5 million. And I think Jay was getting like 5 and 6 million when he was hosting The Tonight Show. So you have to appeal to a mass audience. And yes, you cannot avoid the big stories. You have to talk about Trump. You have to make jokes about Trump. But you do it the way The Tonight Show made jokes about O.J. Simpson. You don't make jokes about the bloody murder victims and the slashed, you know, throats and whatever the graphic details are that, you know, that remind people what a horrible tragedy it was. You make jokes about Judge Ito or Marsha Clark or the jury or Kato Kaelin. The media coverage and the frenzy and all the other stuff. You find a way to make jokes about what people are talking about without making them not want to watch your show. And that's a writing challenge.
Yeah, and I think it's smarter comedy to be able, you know, I mean, a lot of the times people think that the broad joke is the obvious joke, but to me, I think it's smarter comedy and tighter comedy to write jokes that are very funny that everyone can laugh at and play in all parts of the country, not just, you know, a coast or what have you. And I think that you pointed out something that I think is really interesting. I think maybe Stephen Colbert has carried over his cable, his cable ideas and the way that he played on cable television to network television. And I think that was really actually pretty smart observation that, you know, if you're Samantha Bee, you can pick sides. But if you're a late night talk show host on CBS, of all things, you need to be able to be more broad and appeal to more people. You know, I remember, though, in the late show wars in the late 2000s with Conan and Jay and all that, I do remember one time I heard Jay make a joke about Dave. And, you know, to me, whenever they would make jokes about each other, it was kind of like, whoa, what's going on here? And I remember Jay saying to Dave, hey, you know, Dave's killing me every day, Kevin. He's killing me every day. You know, you get Jay, you know how to get David Letterman to ignore you? You marry him. And it was a great joke. It was funny, but even I remember watching it and going, ooh, that was a little
out of character.
That was a little out of character. Was there a time that you can remember real quick that you ever crossed the line with a joke? You know, like Colbert did and maybe like Jay did?
The one example that comes to mind, again, I keep bringing up the OJ trial, but it's a good example of a tricky comedy topic to deal with. We were doing parodies of sitcoms in the style of the OJ trial. Like, we did a parody of the Brady Bunch, except it was the OJ Bunch. So the first time we did a little fake scene from the OJ Bunch, we had Florence Henderson, I guess, plays, you know, the mother. And then we had, you know, Marsha Clark being Marsha Brady. And it played great. So, of course, we said, let's do it again. So the next time we did it, we cast someone to be OJ. And we were doing a little comedy scene in front of the audience, and they were enjoying it. As soon as OJ made his entrance, the audience completely shut down. It was like that was a line we had stepped over, just reminding people, oh, this guy possibly killed two people. We shouldn't be laughing at him. And here he is, like, right on stage as part of the sketch. This is not something we should be laughing at. And so they didn't laugh. So that was kind of a miscalculation. I have a sample joke, a sample Trump joke, if you want to hear this. This is an example of, I think, a joke where even if you were a supporter of President Trump, I think you might still laugh at this. Today was tax day 2017, even for President Trump. He promised to release his tax returns as soon as he filled out a Schedule FU.
See, that's funny. I like that. I'm here in Texas, and I think people in Texas would find that funny.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's okay. Trump would say that's how he would react to people asking him to release his tax returns. He would say F you. But it's a very – so it's – you're making a statement about Trump. It's dealing with what's going on in the world. But at the same time, it's not going to alienate half your potential audience. And that's your job, is to get those people to watch your show, to pay the bills.
Yeah, no, definitely. So two more questions for you real quick, Joe, and then we'll get you out of here. Like I said, I could talk to you forever. I have to know this. How did you almost accidentally set David Letterman on fire twice?
I was talking about the adventures that I used to have on late night, and those were definitely a couple of them. Actually, one of them was the late show. The late night one was – I was involved frequently in dropping stuff off a 5-story tower. And so we used to drop off like frozen turkeys and bowling balls and see what happened when they hit the ground. And that was the comedy piece. So I decided it would be a good idea to fill a watermelon full of napalm and drop that off. And so we were up there on the top of the fire training tower, 5 stories tall. And I mixed up the napalm, and the camera's rolling, and Dave introduces the watermelon and then lights the wick, which is just like an oily rag, kerosene soaked rag, disappearing into the interior of the watermelon full of napalm. And so Dave lights the wick, and I'm there literally like a yard away from it. And Dave is a yard away. It's a small roof. And the thing is burning. The fire is creeping towards the inside of the watermelon, and Dave is not kicking it off. He's not kicking it away so we don't die a fiery death. Finally, at the very last minute, I say, Dave, kick it off. And I was afraid I would ruin the sound or something, but I didn't care because I thought I was going to die. And so finally he kicked it off, and the thing hit the cement below, 5 stories below, and exploded in a flame. And it was just like Dave, he didn't care. So what if it goes up in flames? I never figured out why he just didn't kick it off. And the second time was at CBS. It was one of the things that we taped after the show. It was a little joke outside on the way to another joke in a remote. And the idea was that at that point, the Olympic torch was being run around the country by various runners all over the country. And so I said, all right, Dave, you go outside. An Olympic runner comes up to you with the torch and hands it to you. Like the runner's confused. He thinks you're the next guy. And then, so Dave takes the torch, and the plan is he just kind of tosses it aside and then goes about his business and runs down the street. So we're out there ready to tape the thing. And we have the prop torch, which the prop department made, and it has a little safety switch on it that you have to keep depressed so that the fire will stay lit. But every time the runner passed the torch to Dave, it was the button would be released. It was hard to maintain the pressure on the button. So logically, what would you do? You would tape the button so that the button would remain like on, so that the fire would not go out. So the cameras are rolling. The runner's running down the street, flaming torch. Hands Dave the flaming torch. Dave looks at it as planned, tosses it aside. And the flaming torch rolls underneath the gas tank of a Lincoln Town Car parked at the curb, which nobody had noticed for some reason. So, and because the dead man switch has been taped, the fire is burning under the gas tank. So Dave's security guy happened to be there, and he ran over to the driver's side of the limo. He's pounding on the window, saying, "Move the car, move the car." So luckily, the Lincoln Town Car pulled ahead off the flaming torch before the car and everybody within, you know, 30 feet of it was covered with flaming gasoline. So and it was just, you know, you don't have a lot of time to think about safety sometimes. And
hey,
sometimes
you gotta shoot the comedy, man. Yeah.
Sometimes you're an idiot like me who just has no conception of proper working conditions and respect for the host's life. So take two. We went on to take two.
Well, there you go. Well, Joe, I really appreciate your time. Joe Toplin, you can contact him, joetoplin.com, on Twitter at Joe Toplin. Buy his book, Comedy Writing for Late Night TV, How to Write Monologue Jokes, Desk Pieces, Sketches, Parodies, Audience Pieces, Remotes, and Other Short-Form Comedy. It's available on Amazon.com is where I got mine, and I believe bookstores everywhere should be carrying this book. So go support Joe Toplin. Joe, I mean, I could talk to you all day. You're just a wealth
Thank
of
you,
information,
Brad.
And I really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for asking. It was fun.
Hey, hope to have you on again soon. Thank you so much, Joe.
Thanks again.